Here's what you need to do. You've got to first shave your head. You dress all in black. You've got to wear a white robe. Eat only kosher foods. You've got to become a vegetarian. You face Jerusalem, and you grow a nice big beard. And if you do all of those outward cultural things, you'll discover the God of the universe. And I'm thinking, this is crazy that someone thinks that they can force their culture on God and that God's going to be impressed by what you wear, what direction you face when you pray, what you eat, and all these sorts of things. It seemed to me that if there was a God out there who could be known, he should be able to be recognized no matter where I face, no matter how I'm dressed, because he's God. Growing up, we always understood that we had our Bible and the Gentiles had their Bible, the New Testament, and that they were two completely separate books. And then to hear that the New Testament was written by Jews, I couldn't believe it. My expectation was that the New Testament was like my grandparents had told me. It was a book on how to persecute the Jews, and it's something you should stay away from. Of course, when you're told you should stay away from something, curiosity gets the best of you, and you've got to see it. When I opened the New Testament, I was expecting to find a handbook on how to persecute the Jews. That's what I was expecting to see, and yet when I'm opening it, I'm reading a story written by Jews about Jewish people. The New Testament was a fascinating book. And so as I opened this book in the library, I kind of looked around, made sure that none of my friends had seen me taking a Christian Bible off the shelf. And I opened it. Here's the first sentence. It says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." So three people are mentioned, and they're all Jewish. I was very shocked. And as I continued to read, I'm reading the story of a Jewish man who was born in a Jewish village, in a Jewish country, and one day walks into a synagogue and announces that he is the Messiah. The more I read the words of Jesus, the more I became attracted to him. It was as beautiful as anything I had ever read in any other part of the Bible. As I came to faith that Yeshua, that Jesus was the Messiah, it was clear that that was the most Jewish thing I could do. This is not a person who's a renegade to our people. This is the one who was promised in our Bible. The decision to come to faith in Jesus as the Messiah was not something that was a momentary lark. It wasn't something that was a passing fad. And I could see changes in myself that I knew were not from within myself. I had kind of tapped in to a truth for our Jewish people that was very powerful.
The organization. Oh, you got it. It's all good. It's all good. Technology. The organization that made that video has a bunch of videos. If you could Google that at some point, they are some fascinating videos about Jewish people who've come to faith after discovering Jesus for themselves. And it is amazing, some of these stories. And of course, it's not even just obviously within the Jewish faith. It's amazing to me in my lifetime of following after Jesus to see how much of a change takes place in people's lives when they embrace a belief about Jesus. It is fascinating to me how much what it is that we believe about this person, Jesus, actually affects us, affects how it is that we live in this world, affects our personalities, affects so much. And when I say believe, I'm not just saying an intellectual assent, but embracing this by faith to the point where we're expressing it in our words and in our actions. Who do we think Jesus is? What do we think of Jesus? That, I believe, is one of the most important issues that will ever confront us as human beings, and especially people like us who have such ready access to the information about him. And those who identify with the church, you know, we've got his word. We've got the Bible that God's given to us, and it provides us with this framework of understanding. It highlights aspects about Him that enable us to anchor our feet in trying to wrap our lives around Jesus. The section we're going to be covering in our study in the Gospel of Matthew is one of those pivotal moments of revelation in the narrative. And we're going to get a kind of a quick big picture of things here. We're going to be receiving a foundational view about Jesus, as well as what that means in action, what that means in terms of our lives. And if you'd like to follow along this morning, if you'll find your way over to Matthew chapter 16, this is where we're going to be today. We've just finished the section as we finished chapter 15 and began chapter 16, a section where Jesus was again confronted by the religious leaders who were demanding a sign from Him. And so we consider the dangers of religion that's in and of itself, and a religion that tries to control God as opposed to the simple faith that God calls us to, a humble faith that's just embracing His plan and not dictating to Him what our plan should be. And today, as we pick back up, we're going to cover three sections. It's going to take us through the end of the chapter. Three sections that normally get isolated from each other when this is taught on. And when I taught on it before, I isolated them. And I've come to realize that they're actually vitally connected to each other. They help to inform each other. So we're going to be covering some territory today, but we're going to be looking at what has come to be known as Peter's Great Confession. His confession about who Jesus is. And the subsequent instructions that follow that up actually reveal what that confession looks like in action. In other words, that how this truth about who Jesus is will be expressed in this world. And what we'll read in this passage is going to go a long way towards framing our understanding not only of who Jesus is, but who we are as the church, why we're here on a crummy weather day like this, why we're gathered in this place, and what this is about. So let's do that. Let's get into this. If you're there in Matthew chapter 16, we're going to pick up where we left off, starting with verse 13. It says, "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do people say the Son of Man is?'" Son of Man is something that he's referred to himself often. It does have a connotation to something said in Daniel 7, which is messianic. But by and large, people would refer to themselves as Son of Man in kind of a means of expressing humility about themselves. And they said, verse 14, "And they said, 'Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets.' And he said to them, 'But who do you say that I am?' Simon Peter replied, 'You are the Christ, the Son of the living God.' And Jesus answered him, 'Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. And I tell you, you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell, or Hades, shall not prevail against it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven.' And then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ." Okay, so Jesus takes the disciples on a road trip, and they end up at Caesarea Philippi. Now, that's a place that was way up to the north of where they had been. It's actually at the very boundary of Jewish territory, right up where the tribe of Dan had settled. It was a city that was formerly called Panaeus, named after the Greek god Pan. And you know Pan, right? The little goat man, Tumnus from anyway. So Philip, the son of Herod the Great, he built it up as a monument to Roman society. It was like a place of that showed off the best of Roman society. And so he renamed the city, Caesarea Philippi, or literally what that means is Philip's Caesar town. It's not as poetic as the other, but that's basically what he's saying. And the big attraction in that town was this natural cave, this big cavern entrance where they built up a temple. It was called Pan's Grotto, and that's where they would go and they would do their rites of worshiping Pan. But the locals also had another name for it. Wait for it. The gates of Hades. That's what they would call it. And so they believed there was this deep pool in there. They believed that was the entrance to the underworld, to the realm of the dead. So why did Jesus and his disciples go up there? It certainly doesn't tell us that. Those are the little details that I would love to know that I never find out. It doesn't say, but clearly Jesus wants to put some space between himself and the religious leaders, and he's sure to not bump into any of them up there. But I find it so intriguing that it's up there, in this largely Gentile section of Israel, that Jesus brings them to this watershed moment about his identity. He's not at the temple. He's not in the synagogue in Galilee, but up here in the thick of paganism, Jesus asks this important question, who do people say that I am? Now, this is not Jesus asking whether or not he's popular. This isn't, you know, he's not fishing for likes on Facebook or something like that. He's asking how people are evaluating and understanding his ministry. How do they see him? How do the people at large see me? What do they think is going on here? So they give the variety of answers that they've heard. Some believe it's John the Baptist raised from the dead. And of course, remember a few chapters back, that was Herod, Herod Antipas had that view. He was worried that Jesus was John the Baptist come back from the dead. And so clearly there was this was starting to get some traction. Other people were starting to say these types of things. Fascinates me to no end that people were willing to believe that John the Baptist had come back to life as Jesus, but when Jesus actually comes back to life later on, they don't believe it. Oh, what? Are you crazy? So, okay, if he's not John the Baptist, then he's Elijah or Jeremiah, others that were associated with, you know, prophets who were supposed to appear before the Messiah shows up. Others, they say, think you're like one of the prophets from the old kingdom days, you know, one of the old, like a prophet out of those, out of that style. But all of the options that they offer hold Jesus in high esteem. I mean, they clearly see that he's not just another rabbi in the midst of all the other rabbis that are there in the territory. He's not just your average rabbi. I notice that it's interesting that they neglect to mention what the Pharisees and the religious leaders think about Jesus, because they've got opinions. We've already been reading about it. They believe, remember, that he's in league with Satan, that he's a magician, a false prophet, a madman. Those are some of the things that they've said so far. Disciples leave that part out. Clearly, though, Jesus has gotten everyone's attention at this time, during this, in this region and at this time. People are aware of Jesus. They're just not sure what to make of him or what to do with him. And it's like so many still in our world. People are aware of Jesus. There's a vague awareness of who he is. Very few, it seems like, have a sense of what to do or what to make of him. So Jesus then draws the circle a little bit closer. And he asks his disciples, you know, well, what's your conversation been as it touches me? Who do you think I am? More appropriately, what he's saying there is, you know, why are you here with me? What do you think is going on here? What do you think is happening in this? And Peter seems to speak for the whole group, and he gives his great confession. This is what's been known as Peter's great confession. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, this is the first time in Matthew's gospel that we've actually had a human being. We've heard it from demonic spirits. We've heard it from the narrator. But in the narrative, this is the first time a human being that, like especially one of his close associates, has applied this title to him, Christ. This is the Greek version of the Hebrew word Messiah, which means the anointed one, or probably more appropriately, the anointed king. And it was a term used for the Savior that they were waiting, the Savior of Israel, who is the one who's going to come, that God had sent to bring about the long-awaited restoration, return from exile, and redemption of the kingdom. And so Jesus responds by commending Peter. He blesses him, and he declares that, you know, you just didn't come to this conclusion based on your own human deductive reasoning. This is something else that's happening here. God was awakening something in Peter to accept and then articulate this particular truth. And I love that heaven's reaching into Simon's experience and opening his eyes to be able to see something that's happening here in front of him. Because it indicates to us the fact that he's got to ask this, and that it's a special thing that Simon is able to articulate this, indicates that on the surface, things were not as messianic as everybody would have expected it to be. And it needed this revelation at that point from God for him to see it. And then he goes on to change Simon's name, and it's a word play in the Greek. He says, I'll call you Petros, a small rock, and on this Petra, solid rock, I will build my church. Now, that has been a phrase, you know, this statement here that Jesus makes has not been without controversy over the last 2,000 years of church history. And so we need to take some notes about this curious exchange here, because the two main rivers of Christianity, Protestants and Catholics, view this entirely differently. They understand and interpret this completely differently. So there are two views about what it means as it touches Simon Peter here. Some believe that this refers to Peter as the rock, that Jesus is calling Peter the rock, or they'll say he's the first bishop of the church. He was the Roman Catholic, he was the beginning of the Roman Catholic, apostolic succession. So he was basically the first pope over the church. And this was something that arose in about the third century. So the idea is that Peter had primacy. He was the first pope. All other popes that succeed him carry on this same apostolic succession and carry on this unique calling that Peter had among all the rest of them. The thing about that interpretation is that it's not even hinted at anywhere in the context of what Jesus is saying directly in this. But it's never presented that way in the book of Acts. We can go through the entire book of Acts. You're never going to see this concept represented there among them. We can get into the epistles then later on, where Paul is writing and Peter himself is writing, and we don't find this concept represented, that Peter somehow is elevated above the rest, and he's the one who controls what it is that's happening there in the church. So it was clearly not a first century concept, and we really don't see that crystallizing into a developed doctrine until around the time of Charlemagne. We don't really see it prior to that. So the majority of Protestants view it differently. Ever since the Reformation, believe that this is something that this is referencing the words that Peter makes, the confession of faith. It's not talking about the rock upon which he's building his church is not Peter himself, but the confession that Peter is making. I am persuaded that that's more likely. I do believe, I mean, the language is clear. He is talking to Peter, but I believe Peter is like a stand-in for all who adhere to this belief about Jesus. He stands there representing everyone who makes this same confession of faith. So therefore, the confession itself actually does end up being the rock on which he builds his church. And that's actually something that Peter himself says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. You actually find that articulated by him, that God is building up his church on us, the living stones. So basically, all who share this confession are the ones on whom Christ is building, and what he's building is extremely important. Jesus says that on this foundation he will build his ecclesia. That is the church. And this is the very first mention we ever have of this thing called church in all of the New Testament. When I left the church as I'd known it, and you know, you've heard me go on and on ad nauseum about the crazy church that I was a part of. But when I'd left church as I knew it, and when several of us set out to start this experiment to see if there was some different way to go about this, this passage was a pivotal passage for me. Because this is a defining passage for what it means to be the church. You want to know what something is about, you go back to its basic core definition. And when all things are stripped down to its basic essential core identity of what the church is, we learn here that what it is to be the church is founded on the confession that Jesus is the one true King. And everything that implies. And of course, you may say, well, no duh, Rob. I mean, but I do think this is something that needs to be revisited in our thinking on a regular basis. Ekklesia is the Greek word that Jesus uses here, and it means an assembly of people. Literally, it connotes being called out of your home and called into an assembly of people. In this case, Jesus is saying that his followers are ones who are called out of these broken systems of this world and assembled and gathered around this core belief that Jesus is our King and everything that that means, that he is our Savior. He is the means of our reconciliation with God. He is the one through whom God's kingdom. We're called out of the broken systems of this world and called in to join in to God's kingdom, which is setting up a whole new world, is forecasting and representing a whole new world. So the church is a gathering of people that gather around this core belief that Jesus is, well, you could say it in a more ambiguous way, but Jesus is the answer, the thing that we've been looking for. Jesus is the one through whom we find reconciliation with God. That is what the church is. And, you know, we've stated it many, many times. The church isn't a building. I'm so glad for that, because we would be a very, very sad church if it were a building. It's not an institution. It's not a program. It's not a show. It's not the amenities that we can put together or the services that we can provide or anything like that. It's not a marketing scheme. It is people like you and I who come out in weather like this and gather around this central claim that Jesus is King. That no matter what is going on in this world, Jesus is King. The central truth that binds us together is Jesus, His Lordship, His salvation, His redemption, His return. Those are the things that bind us together. And we may have varied views on what those things look like. That's all right. We may have differences of opinion about those types of things, but we will have Jesus at the center of it all. Jesus will be the core of everything that happens. So it's not our political views. It's not our cultural interests or prejudices. It's not our own interests or agendas, but it's Jesus as King. That's the center of everything that's going on here. That's what the church is. That's what any church that's you'll find anywhere, that's what it's about. Jesus at the center of it, proclaimed as King. And Jesus encourages us that that's enough. You know, you can say, well, that just doesn't seem that, you know, sustainable. But Jesus said, no, that's actually enough. He's saying that our faith in that truth is going to enable this gathering to endure through the ages. It's not going to stop, in other words. In verse 18, when he says the gates of Hades won't prevail over the church, well, that was a euphemism at that time, that a euphemism for death's inevitable power over humanity. So in one sense, he's saying the church is not going to die. The church is just going to keep going on. And that's true even on theological levels. But given where they're standing, given the fact that there is a place, maybe right over his shoulder, that was literally called the gates of Hades in the thick of paganism, I believe it's also saying that this broken, idolatrous world system that's going to oppose Jesus as being King will not prevail as well. That nothing that this world, or seen or unseen, can throw at the church, God's gathering of people around this truth that Jesus is King, nothing is going to prevail in stopping it from doing this. Satan cannot triumph over the church, is what he's saying. In all of Satan's sphere of influence, and specifically death, of course, death will ultimately be defeated. And we think about that all through church history. The church has undergone persecution, has undergone all the extremes. It's undergone persecution, but it's also undergone absorption into culture. It's undergone martyrdom as well as the corruption of power on its side. For 2,000 years, the church has been subject to these kinds of things, and yet here we are this morning, gathered around this central truth that Jesus is King. And not just us, but all up and down, in this city, in this state, in this country, and in every country around the world. They're gathering together around this central theme that Jesus is King. And we've been doing it for 2,000 years, and nothing has been able to stop that from happening. And all the different ways in which it was tried to be eradicated from the earth, it's never been successful. And here we are still today. As well as every other place where the church is gathering. And Jesus is indicating in his statement, and wow, what a prophetic statement. I mean, how is he going to be able to recognize? And even if you were to take the opinion that this was something that Matthew wrote, that Jesus may not have said, how would Matthew have known that this was going to endure this steadfastly for this long? I'm telling you, that's nothing to sneeze at. This is an amazing thing that's happened here with the longevity of the church. It's exciting. It's empowering, right? I mean, to think about how God has made this promise that this is going to keep going. And he even talks about the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and of binding and of loosing, which is either an indication of the authority to record scripture, as some understand it, or it's about the cooperative effort of reaching bound souls and loosing them, or it's about spiritual warfare. And I'll just tell you, there is absolutely no consensus on this as to what this actually means. The only consensus we have is that we're given the keys. And this is important, that the idea that the church on earth is given the keys to the kingdom of heaven. That is access to heaven and the workings of God's realm, and the work of heaven is now going to intersect with those of us who are working here on the earth. So there's something even magnificent about that. So the promise to this church, founded on Jesus as King, is that we will ultimately prevail. We'll overcome our enemy Satan and death, because through Jesus, we now have access to God's realm and his purposes in advancing his kingdom. I mean, that's awesome stuff, right? I mean, it's not just, you know, gathering around and we've got to kill some time on a Sunday morning before football starts or whatever. I mean, there's something important that happens just even in the gathering together. That just being here together around this central truth is part of the fulfillment of what it is that Jesus said was going to be happening here. We're part of this amazing, earth-shaking kind of thing. I mean, it can get you stoked. It gets you ready to take on anything. I'm sure that the disciples felt that way too. You know, even though Jesus warns them, you know, don't tell anybody that the Christ is here, because you're talking about a rival king, and, you know, Caesars have a way of not liking rival kings, and so, you know, let's don't stir something up before it's time. But still, they had to be feeling awesome, right? Like invulnerable at this moment. They're with God's Messiah. He's just admitted it to them. This is happening. Everything they've been waiting for is finally happening. The kingdom of heaven has come to earth to set all things right. So, you know, let's roll. Let's go get them. This is going to be awesome. And from that high note, we move to verse 21. And from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go up to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, no, far be it from you, Lord. This is never going to happen to you. But he, Jesus, turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're a hindrance to me. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. I love this scene. I imagine this scene in my mind. The disciples, they are beyond stoked. You can imagine, they're marching out with just this whole new energy and excitement. You know, Jesus is Messiah. Yay! He says we're going to triumph. Yay! He says his enemies are going to kill him. Yay! Wait, what? I don't think they even heard him talk about rising on the third day. They just heard that first part and were incredulous, as we would be too. This cross is the rub. That's what they had great difficulty understanding prior to the resurrection, but it's something that we still struggle with to this very day. Jesus revealed to us that God's way of overcoming this world is vastly different from the way the kingdoms of this earth advance. Because Christ's kingdom overcomes this world through sacrificial love. Now, Peter especially didn't get it, and, you know, since he's so favored by Jesus, he's just gotten this, you know, big commendation. He takes Jesus aside to instruct him a little bit and explain to him how things work. Listen, there's no way, Lord. It's never going to happen to you. I mean, it doesn't work that way, Jesus. You don't get it. You can't win by being defeated. You're not going to, you know, set all things right by dying. That doesn't work like that. And according to the way this broken world works, he's right. He's absolutely right. But here, Peter gets rebuked, and man, what a fast downfall, you know, for this guy. He goes from being called blessed by Jesus to then be called Satan, literally my enemy, telling him, you know, to get behind him. In other words, get in line behind me. Don't get out in front of me. Get behind me. Then he goes from being commended for hearing from heaven and not from flesh and blood to being rebuked for minding fallen human ideas instead of God's plan. So they all parallel each other. He goes from being called a rock to literally being called a stumbling stone. The ESV words it as a hindrance, but the word is scandalon. It means a stone that you stumble over. So, I mean, the rise and fall of Peter, it's pretty fast, and I relate to it a lot. But he and the others, they couldn't seem to grasp that Jesus was revealing the very otherworldly ways that God's kingdom is going to be at work in this world. He's saying, you know, I know, Peter, I know that it doesn't work like this in this world system, but I am revolutionizing that. I'm doing something different from the way this world works. So Jesus is beginning the process here of reinterpreting for them what being Messiah really means and what following that Messiah is going to entail for his disciples. Jesus told Pilate in his trial in John's gospel, he said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my followers would rise up in arms and fight on my behalf." And when he's saying, "My kingdom is not of this world," he's not trying to say, it's far, far away somewhere else. No, he's saying it doesn't use the methodology of this world. That's why my followers aren't going to rise up and fight like that, because it's not of the patterns of this world. Later on in this gospel, Peter's going to grab a sword and fly into the thick of all of those who are coming to arrest Jesus, and Jesus rebukes him again there. Says, "Put that away. Don't do that. Violence is just going to incite more violence." And then he says, "Don't you think that my Father would send hordes of angel armies here to fight on my behalf if it was going to work that way? But that's not the way it's working." No, Jesus reveals a victory that comes through a strange new power, strange to this world. The power of sacrificial love, a self-giving love that wins its victory not through force or coercion, but through this unrelenting forgiveness and a love that refuses to be partitioned off, a love that's expressed everywhere. That's the power, he says, that overcomes the world. That is the power that Messiah, that Jesus the King, has come to reveal. But not only that, and just to warn you, this gets worse. Verse 24. "And Jesus told his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his or her life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then will repay to each person according to what he's done, or grant to each person, or provide for each person what's intended. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." These last couple verses we're going to deal with more next week. If it was startling to hear that Jesus was going to go off and have to endure his own cross, then he kind of ramps up the irony and explains to his disciples that, "Oh yeah, and you guys are going to be doing that too. In fact, that's the way you're going to follow me." And what he's telling them, and he's telling us as this church that is founded on Christ as King, which means we follow his ways and we follow him, that the church's mission is the ongoing expression of sacrificial love. I can't even imagine what must be going through the disciples' minds at this point. Because for us, the cross is so sanitized. Fine, that's all right. Because the cross, because of what Jesus has done, has turned into this amazing symbol of divine love. But in some ways, we sentimentalize that, we romanticize that. The disciples would not have seen it that way at all. And we've got to step back into first century Palestine under Roman rule and try to grasp this from their perspective on this. They would not have seen it as anything romantic in the least, nor would they have imagined that Jesus was just telling them, you need to endure your grouchy boss or put up with ingrown toenails as your cross to bear or something like that. No, to them, the cross was an instrument of death. It conjured up images of being marched through the public, through the streets, on your way to a torturous execution. That's what they knew the cross to be. Those were the images they grew up with. They've grown up under Roman rule. They probably knew people from their neighborhood who had undergone that torturous kind of death. They certainly, even if they didn't know people, they certainly would have seen it on a regular basis, because this was Rome's favorite method of crowd control. This was their ad campaign. "Hi, we're Rome. We're here to bring roads and aqueducts. And if you don't want that, we've got this cross." I mean, that was their whole thing, to keep people in line. This was a graphic image that Jesus is employing here. He's telling us to follow him. And if we're going to follow him, to be his community of people that is gathered around this truth that he is king, then we have to advance God's kingdom the way that he did. This great paradox that Jesus presents us as the cross, that of gaining life by losing our life. And he's not speaking necessarily of martyrdom, though we know that church history and even church presently undergoes that sort of persecution to the point of holding fast to this truth at the loss, at the loss of life. But it means something else. It's even deeper than just that, because he's saying in this that we are dying then to the methodology of the world, the methodology of this broken world with its politics of compulsion, and that we realize that our own will of our own will and self-advancement as an attempt to save ourselves is going to come up woefully short in terms of what it is that God intends for us. That we have to find our lives reshaped in the mold of Jesus, the one who loves sacrificially, who came to serve and not to be served, who forgave those who killed him, who blessed those who cursed him. And we might, you know, stagger back at that and say, well, how am I supposed to do that? How am I ever going to get anywhere if I'm like that? Why would I do that? I mean, why? And again, I'm going to qualify this because these things come up, you know, somebody's in an abusive relationship and say, well, okay, so this means I just put up with it or whatever. We're not saying that. And obviously he's not trying to lay out parameters there for putting ourselves in unnecessary danger, which is what that would be. But he's just talking about a life that's not guided by ego as the first and foremost means by which we make our choices in this world. And again, we could say, well, why? Why would I do that? I mean, I can't see how I would be anything but a doormat. What would I get out of this? How would that possibly benefit me to do that? And there's where Jesus throws this in here, and it's so intense, and it's really quite heavy. He's saying, you can gain stuff here. You could actually get ahead here in this broken world system. But what good does it do? You could gain the whole world and end up losing your soul. So then we have to decide. And that's where he always leaves it, back with us, to make that decision. Which is more important? I mean, the chapter ends off with this tease about the glory to come, something that's going to lead us into the next chapter. But he's putting that big picture up there again. Why would we do this? Why would we live like this? Why would we put our ego aside and yield to the calling of Christ in the face of all of the pressures of this world? Why would we endure that sort of thing now? Because of the glory that is yet to be revealed. And that's something that's, I mean, in an eschatological sense, the glory of God's kingdom when it gets revealed, but it's even more than that. The glory that gets revealed in our character. Right here and now, as those changes begin to take place. The glory that's revealed in the return to original intent for humanity. To the glory then that ultimately is revealed in this unending life of wholeness, as God puts all things right side up again. I mean, that's what we have to consider and think about. And we're in a very sensual society, which means that everything affects us in the temporal. Everything is so demanding in the temporal. And we have to think, what's more important to us in this? The trinkets and the affirmations that we can gather up here now in this broken world, or wholeness in life? Which would be more important? What would you trade for it? What would you trade for wholeness, for security in knowing that we're in relationship with God? And this all sort of brings it all back full circle to where this all started, where Jesus began by asking his disciples who they thought he was, asking in essence, why are you with me? Why are you here? And it's a good question to ask ourselves from time to time. Why am I here? Why do I come to church? What am I expecting? What do I really believe about Jesus? Where do I think this is going? How far am I willing to go in expressing his sacrificial love, and what are my expectations in return? They're important questions to ask. To identify with the church means we're embracing the claim that Jesus is the one true king. His victory is going to come through, has already come through sacrificial love, and our mission is to advance that same love in the world where we've been placed. So as we follow Jesus. Just as in the opening video, this guy talks about the things that began to change in his life, that he had tapped into a power to change that he hadn't been aware of before. And as we follow Jesus, things will change. We will change. Our relationships will change. The world where we live is going to change. And change means losing things the way they were. But if we've caught Jesus' vision for how God's redeeming this world, we know that what we gain from that is far greater than any of those chains that we drop along the way. Jesus brings us out of the old ways of being and relating that lead to sorrow and death so that we can be free for the new ways of relating to each other. And in the self-giving love in which Jesus is forming us, we find a real wholeness. We find a well-being in him that never, ever ends. So the challenge is to be the gathering of the church, not to see this building as a church, not to see our programs or what amenities we may have as the church. Let's be the gathering of the church. Let's embrace Jesus' rule over our lives and over this world. And then let's take up his challenge to change this world through that same self-giving, sacrificial love. Right on? Heavy stuff, I know, but it's good stuff. So why don't you stand up with me if you will, please. Father, I just pray that that we embrace this challenge. And Lord, I certainly don't know everybody's mindset as we gather here for the church to be the church. And I don't know what everyone thinks of you. But I pray that you do for everyone here what you did for Peter and allow heaven to expand our understanding and our thinking. And we invite you, Father, to come and awaken our hearts and illuminate our thinking to understand what it means to be your follower, what it means to be the church, to be part of this amazing thing you've been doing for all of these years of revealing your goodness and your healing rule through formerly broken lives, through broken healers, Father. Help us to embrace what this means and to step into it, to take our place in representing your love in this world. I pray that for everyone who's here, Father. We ask this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, let's speak this blessing on each other. If anybody needs prayer for anything, we'd love to pray with you. Come on up and we'll see what God will do. But let's speak this together. May Christ be a light to illumine and guide you. Christ be a shield to overshadow you. Christ be under you, Christ be over you, Christ beside you, on your left and on your right, both in this world and the one to come. Go in peace, you children of God.